Good evening to all of you, Hernan. Thank you for welcoming me. This time I was quite an unexpected guest because I was not expected to come to New Zealand. So I'm happy to, despite the unexpectedness of my visit, having been received in a very loving way, as usual, like they say in the Veda, Titi Devo Bhavan, an unexpected guest is to be treated as God himself. I'm an unexpected guest to begin with, at least, and Sri Krishna would try to treat me today as God himself, trying to throw me petals when I was entering, but the wind brought all the petals back to him. That was an interesting welcoming ceremony that I did. So, at the end, he went in front of me, just like he won. Forceful Pushpanjali. But yeah, besides that, I'm very happy to be here, despite again, it was not the original plan I had in mind, but for some reason, we had to be here. I'm always happy to visit all of you, both South Island, Northern Ireland. It's all one island, it's all one family, right? Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. This beautiful idea that there's only one family. We are all relatives, basically. Not only human species, but everything is relative because everything is, I mean, the very word relative. My relatives means something with who I exist in relation to, with relation, relative. So everything is interconnected, everything is in relationship with everything. We're all relatives. And so one big family. So today during lunch, we were thinking about what to speak about today, what to share about. We were brainstorming a little bit after during lunch, and we decided to share a few words about a book I published a few months ago, maybe half a year ago, which is Evolution in Divine Love. A book that I've been speaking about a little bit throughout the last, well, since it was published, so the last half a year. And basically, this last days here with you is the conclusion of my travels of this year, and my speaking on whatever particular book I published for the last years that ended up being the case. Like it, I end up publishing a book, and my travels are somehow revolving around the book. So probably next book, there's another book to be published on unconditional love. So probably I will be speaking more about that, although it's always interconnected. So these few days with you, maybe, yeah, my last public opportunity to say something more officially about this third book. So at least today we'll share some thoughts about that, and also we'll have open space tomorrow and the days after tomorrow for any questions or topics you may like to bring in any direction. Well, we've been talking the last few days in the Southern Island about some of the topics of the book. The book speaks about the nature of love, which for me there's no better topic to speak about. I always remember this beautiful poem by Hafiz. I mean, there's a whole book, a compilation of his poems that is called "The Subject Tonight Is Love." And the poem basically says the subject tonight is love. In fact, I don't find any other better topic to speak about for the rest of eternity. So not only tonight, but the subject forever is love. The deeper we go into our life, into our practice, we realize, yeah, the only subject is love, and everything else can be spoken of in connection to love. Nothing exists isolated from love. The fact that we think it does That's a symptom of our illusion, basically. So we've been talking, the book is an exploration of love and the nature of love as ever evolving, always growing, always expanding, always inviting for more love, love in need of more love. That's an interesting idea. Love satisfies all necessities. Love creates its own necessity in the form of further love. And that creates the eternal possibility of ongoing pursuit of love. And that makes the spiritual world an exciting possibility, you know, where there is development and growth and expansion. Because as we were saying the other day, if we will think about eternity, an eternity where there are no surprise, no news, no growth, no development, it's always the same. It's like an eternal dead end. That's not a, that sounds like hell, not like the spiritual world. So that's a spiritual world. I don't want to go there. But thank God that's not the spiritual world. It's a real world Vaikuntha without limits. It's known as Vraj. Vraj means to move, to go, implies movement, growth, expansion. So we explore these days how these past days, how love is moving, growing, and that makes for Krishna, for the divine, to be also moving. In fact, almost every picture of we see of Krishna, he's moving, he's dancing. You never see Krishna sitting on a chair, like arms crossed, like what to do now. He's always an exuberant celebration of life, like exploding from the inside. And I have to dance, I have to celebrate. Every time we see a deity of Mahaprabhu, Nityananda Prabhu, everyone is like arms raised, dancing posture, Krishna playing the flute, singing. Being too inspired, that it's uncontainable. Do you have that word in English? That you cannot contain? It's uncontainable. No, that's the nature of bhakti. Haituki, apratihata. Haituki, bhakti comes from bhakti, is its own cause. Apratihata is uncontainable. It's too much to be contained. We are meant to be flooded by bhakti. It's an ocean. Even one, as we saw the other day, even one drop from that ocean can drown you in nectar for eternity. Just one drop. So that invites, if love is ever evolving, love is in constant expansion, uncontainable expansion, Krishna becomes every day more Krishna, more beautiful, more the all attractive, more inspired to dance and sing new songs. That also sends us an invitation to dance, send to dance, to learn new steps into the dance every single day, every single night. Krishna is having Rasa Lila with the gopis in Vrindavan, learn new steps to learn in the dance of love. And everyone is willing to go, and everyone is willing to learn. And all that takes the dance to a new level, takes the song to a new level. The scripture is described every time Krishna has Rasa Lila with the gopis. New ragas are created in his flute that have never been heard before by anyone. Even the devas and the gandharvas and all these ultra sophisticated artists hear that new combination of notes and it's like, wow, that's unprecedented. That's uncontainable. They faint. So that's an every night, every day event in eternity. Those are poetic ways also of speaking about how love is in constant blooming, constant blossoming. It's an ongoing blossom. So we are invited to that. That's the potential of the jiva, of the atma, of the soul. To live a life of ever-evolving love, ever-evolving celebration. Never boring, never stagnant, never static. Which begins, as we said the other day, begins in the here and now. We are all invited to acknowledge, wow, I'm practicing bhakti, and this is what I want to do forever. Wow, I'm doing that already. I'm already doing what I want to do forever. I'm in forever, therefore. I'm already doing what I want to do for eternity. Somehow I'm in eternity. That's what it means to be in eternity. It's not like a mothership come from another planet and a few UFOs kidnap you and okay, now I'm thrown into eternity. But when you experience even something like you feel, oh, I could be doing this forever. I don't want to make assumptions, but I suspect that when you were listening today to Sri Krishna Prabhu's kirtan, that nice melody, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I can hear that melody for eternity, he sung by him. Okay, glimpses of eternity. We could be doing this forever. Okay. Then you are in eternity, that moment. That's the grace of bhakti. No? It doesn't wait for the afterlife. It's not like a wait till you die, till the afterlife for getting a glimpse of what's actually going on. So, whereas what happens after death is, in one sense, no longer a mystery. Because we're already having glimpses and more glimpses and more glimpses on the day-to-day basis. And then the passing of the leaving of this biological body is just like a continuation into those glimpses that become less and less glimpses and more the continuous experience. So these are some of the topics that we have been talking about these days in the Southern Island, corresponding to some of the chapters of my book. My book speaks in four chapters about the ever-evolving nature of love, then the ever-evolving nature of God, then the ever-evolving nature of us, our potential. And the last chapter, I like to speak today about it. And the last chapter could have been the first chapter also. For those of you who feel, oh, Maharaj, you're coming day one and you're talking about the last chapter of your book, that makes no sense. Why you don't start again with the first one? Have my YouTube channel there. The classes are there if you want to see. But I am compensating by saying that the last chapter, for many reasons, could have been the first because it's a chapter on matter, the material energy, which for many of us is, for most people, maybe not for us, but maybe also, is the most immediate of all realities. For some people, if I talk to them about love, God, the soul, it's like that's all new agey, subtle stuff. Let's go to the concrete reality, matter. Yeah, let's begin there. Somehow I chose matter to at the end because I thought, okay, let's begin talking about love, which is for me the foundation of everything. But in many ways, we could have started talking about matter. As our own tradition does, trying to show how the world, material world, is our mother in one way. Mother nature, mother earth, matter comes from mother. The word matter comes from mother. So if we don't learn to have a healthy relationship with mom, we will be pretty dysfunctional children, literally. Of course, not only, of course, also our biological mother, but the micro mother and the macro mother, the cosmological mother also. So if our relationship with matter is not healthy, it's not positive, it's not God-centered, that may get in the way of our pursuit of the divine, because as we say before, everything is interrelated, everything is interconnected. We are all relatives. Not only us, not only those who share with us our surname, last name, all of us, including matter. Matter is my relative. We could say matter is my mother. It's not just a relative, it's mom. Bhumi Ma, some will say. There are different ways to refer to the goddess, the sacred mother, and so on and so forth. So, what is our relationship with mother, with matter, with mother? So, in one sense, that's the very first things to speak about. How you are dealing with the womb from which you are coming. In one sense, if the matter is seen as mother. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, interestingly, starts right there. You pay attention, if we pay attention, when Parikshit Maharaj presents his main questions at the beginning of the Bhagavatam, I mean, the second canto. As we know, he has a few days to live. He has a few important questions, more related to, okay, how to prepare myself for death, what's the ultimate duty for all living beings, and so on and so forth. And the very first thing that Sukadeva Goswami says in answer to that, he starts to describe the Virat Rupa. Apparently, in this connection to these questions, because Pariksit Maharaj never asks Sukadeva Goswami, what's the Virat Rupa? Or the cosmos, is the cosmos divine or not? He asks, what's the goal of life? What to do? How to prepare myself for death? How I guess fun. He starts to speak about the world in connection to God, like implying if you don't get this lesson right first, you probably will miss all the other lessons that come after that. So first, let's build a healthy relationship with the mother, so to say. First, let's get matter right. So he starts to describe Virat Rupa, which is to learn to see the cosmos with God inside of it. Oh, the rivers are the veins of God. And each material manifestation is an aspect of God's body. It's more like a archetypal meditation visualization, but it's a way of trying to take us to see the world with God in it. God in the world in God, panentheism. Krishna says that in the Gita. Yo mam pasyati sarvatra, sarvam chamahi pasyati. I am in everything. Everything is in me. Krishna is in the world of matter. Matter is in God. Well, that's sacred then. Srila Prabhupada will say, it's a beautiful quote. I mentioned that in my book. He will say, God, Krishna is omnipresent. Which again, it's a basic idea that sometimes we take for granted. Krishna is omnipresent. God is everywhere. And then he says, God is omnipresent, and wherever God is, that's his temple. Now, if you know basic math, you will put if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. So if God is everywhere, and whatever God is his temple, then you tell me. I didn't say it. Everywhere is his temple. There is not a place that is not his temple. Oh, that's an interesting idea. I'm saying all this why? Because sometimes, somehow, inadvertently, some of us, I'm not saying you, all of you, some of you, I don't know. Some of us, I include myself, my previous years, had a relatively negative idea toward matter. Towards the world of matter, and the practice was more kind of mukti oriented. Basically, I'm doing bhakti to get out of here as soon as possible. Right? Some sort of evacuation plan into the afterlife. That's bhakti. Evacuation plan into the afterlife. But our goal is not mukti, right? Our goal is prem. And when you have prem, the symptom of prem is God is everywhere and everything's in God. So you don't feel the need to go anywhere because you already are there. We don't need to go somewhere. We need to go to prem. Whenever you attain prem as an inner state, then you have arrived to whenever you had to arrive. There's no need to make an external change of environment. So everywhere is Krishna's temple. Everyone is God. Every atom is a temple. Wow. We are becoming too poetic at this point. Right? Every atom is oozing with the presence of the divine. Every atom is an embassy of the sweet absolute. We need to resort to poetry. There's no other option at one point. But it's funny because that's a fact. Brahma Samhita says, Govinda Abdi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. One verse says, Govinda is in every atom, literally. Fully present in every atom, subatomic particles, the space in between subatomic particles, everywhere. That means omnipresent. So every atom of this, how do you say, call this?
Cushion, cushion.
Cushion, sorry. It's pervaded. It's oozing with the presence of Krishna. How can I dare to say this despicable matter, an obstacle to my path, and I need to get away from here as soon as possible? I'm insulting an embassy of the divine. Watch out for that. Vishwanath Chakravarti, there's a nice verse in the Bhagavatam that actually says, we must meditate on the interaction between Krishna and the material nature. It's a verse that is recommending to contemplate how matter and God are connected. And in the commentary on that verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, we should have faith that matter, material energy, is a Vaishnavi of the highest order. I'll repeat just in case. We should have faith that matter is a Vaishnavi of the highest order. And it's very interesting, he starts saying we should have faith, like implying probably you don't have faith in that. So it's important to understand that material energy is a Vaishnavi, topmost Vaishnavi. So if I say this material energy is crap, I'm committing Vaishnavi aparadh. Right? Vaishnavi aparadh. There are different offenses, even different forms of Vaishnava aparadh. Some of them is like being violent toward Vaishnava, beating a Vaishnava, insulting a Vaishnava, thinking bad about Vaishnava. So I'm fine thinking matter is this, matter is that, I'm talking about that. Probably I will end up treating matter literally very bad. And that's what happens in this world. In big part, that's an interesting scholarly research done decades ago, which somehow connects the current ecological crisis we are going through. One of the main causes for the current ecological crisis, religion. Why? Because religion has posited, historically has posited God as an otherworldly being, utterly transcendent, not immanent, not present here and now, but just far away, future tense, above the clouds, and this world is left as profane. So if you cannot find God here, you start to treat this world as not divine. And start to think about that, you start to speak about that, you start to treat it in that way. And then you have the ecological crisis, you have Vaishnavi aparadh, which is a big obstacle to bhakti, right? Aparadh, we don't want to. Aparadh means to go against love, that which opposes Radha, aparadha. So learning to properly revere matter is a crucial aspect of bhakti. Aparadha means to go against love. So the opposite of going against love is being loving, being kind, being respectful and honoring. Or to speak in relation to a Vaishnava, Vaishnavi of the highest order, as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said. So the fourth chapter of my book is all about that. How matter is, the name of the chapter is The Depths of Matter. Like indicating matter is not just a mere surface thing. There's so much going on in the depths of matter. Even if none of us will be Gaudiya Vaishnavas and all of us will be just secular scientists having a technical conference today, we will all know probably better than us. If you just bring a good telescope, you will be just seeing beyond the surface of matter and you will be a wonder. Even if you won't mention, ascribe all that to God or anything, but you will be shockingly marveled, like, what's going on in this carpet? These are really magical carpets. Every carpet is a magical carpet. Even the cushion is a magical cushion. You just need to scratch a little bit beyond the surface, and it's like, wow, so much is going on. What to speak if then we add on top of that, and Krishna is residing in every atom, dancing in every atom. singing through every atom. In scientific terms, we will speak more in terms of frequency, vibration. Every atom is vibrating a certain frequency. There is resonance. But basically, we are saying there is sound and there is movement in matter. Now, even if this doesn't seem to be moving at all, something's going on. No, even I don't know, mountains. Generally, we think of mountains as the most immovable thing possible. But you do any geological study, and they will tell you every year mountain moves a few centimeters. So everything's moving. I mean, we are so unaware of the movements of matter. Every day in our body, there are millions of cells that are being renewed. Every day. Millions. Probably we are not aware of that. The day passes, and it's okay if we will be aware of all that, will be overwhelming, probably. It's too much of too big of an event. But just to hear a few of those things, I think helps to recalibrate our perspective and approach matter with more caution, with more respect. And understanding if I relate to matter properly, if I relate to a Vaishnava properly, Bhagavatam says, Brijusnik dasa sisasya guru bogu yama pyuta. If you approach guru with affection and sincerity, that person will reveal you all his secrets, all her secrets. So if you approach a Vaishnava with authenticity, respect, openness, so many secrets will be. So material energy is a Vaishnavi. If you approach nature, if you approach matter with proper respect, so many secrets will be revealed. Because Krishna is residing in every atom of it. So there's a lot to learn from that. No wonder the Bhagavatam, when it mentions 24 gurus, 11th canto, 24 gurus. First of all, of those 24, 21 are aspects of nature. 21. Now, the wind, the moon, the sun, this animal, that animal, this spider, this snake. 21. Three human. But those three human are a baby, a girl, and a prostitute. No? Interestingly. Like implying you can learn from everywhere. Ultimately, guru is everywhere. And the first of all those 24 is the earth. Like another way of saying, start there. Try to have a healthy relationship with matter. Try to learn. Try to make matter your guru somehow. You were with me here, most of you, last year. Maybe all of you, I don't know. No, not all of you, but most of you. What we were studying last year. Yes. More officially, the third verse of Shikshastaka. Okay. Which implies we were studying grass. Yes.
This year,
But it was this year, sorry. I confused you when I said last year. Maybe you were thinking because I came also then. So the beginning of this year. And we were studying this verse that we introduced us. This is the most important thing that Mahaprabhu ever said. Most Gaudiya Vaishnava will agree. This is the golden rule of the Golden Lord, which presents us with a golden opportunity. Everything becomes golden. But what's that verse about? In essence, what I was just saying, if you approach a Vaishnava with proper attitude, Vaishnava will reveal all its secrets. Mahaprabhu is approaching nature with proper attitude. Grass is revealing all its secrets. Trees revealing all its secrets. No? Grass is teaching humility. Trees teaching tolerance, forgiveness, compassion. And those are two examples only. No? I mean, the third verse of Shikshastaka could have been extended to every element of nature. Mahaprabhu just picked two, not because only those two have something to teach us. It's everywhere. But let's start with two. With those two that probably you will never think about on a daily basis. You're just walking on top of the grass, surrounded by trees, but you never even notice there are trees. Mahaprabhu was paying very close attention. Oh, so much was coming to him. So once that's the most important instruction in our tradition. And it's all about matter as guru. Right? And this verse of Sikshastakam corresponds with the stage of Nishta, which probably some of us, or most of us, may be after it, may not yet be there, I don't know. But generally, it's a goal to achieve for many, which is fine. But the point is, we want that. We want to achieve certain stability and balance in our practice that allows us to be present enough. So I can listen and I can see things for what they are. I can be in front of a tree and actually see the tree for what the tree is, a guru. I can be looking at the grass and I can have enough contemplative capacity to engage in conversation with the grass, not just walk on the grass, but have the level of presence that makes me aware of, wow, I'm surrounded by whole parampara here. Tree parampara, grass parampara, guru parampara here, guru parampara there. Wow. At our stage, maybe we may need to force that a little bit. Okay, go for a walk in nature. Don't take your cell phone. Don't take anything. Don't even take your japa mala, with all respect, with the japa mala, of course. Just be in nature. Listen to the river. Embrace the tree. Listen to the tree. Try to remind yourself the sacredness of everything. That may help to begin with. Again, as Prabhupada said, temple is everywhere. Krishna is everywhere. Wherever he is a temple. There is one interesting comment that Sanatana Goswami makes in Brihadbhagavatamrita. These are one of those small one-liners that, I mean, the whole book is filled with jewels, but even if the whole book will have nothing else to say, which is not the case, of course, just this line is, well, sometimes it happens to me. I'm reading some book and different books, not only Gaudiya Vaishnava book. Sometimes some books are, to be honest, not that interesting, but I have this somehow rigidity that if I start a book, I have to finish it. I don't know if that's too. Probably I need to transcend the tendency because sometimes, like, okay. But interestingly enough, there is always some one line that is like, oh, this justifies the whole book. So, in one line, and again, I'm not saying this is Brihadbhagavatamrita because that's one of my favorite books filled with jewels. And one of those jewels is Sanatana Goswami saying something very simple but very powerful in connection to what we are talking about. He will say, remember, we are talking about the third verse of Sikshastakam, nature as guru revealing all her secrets to us if we approach it properly. And he will say, if you learn to relate to a blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is, you can attain all perfection. So that's a very interesting method, perfection. If you just learn to relate to one blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is, not for what we think it is, all perfection is in there. Because ultimately, the blade of grass, if you approach it from a proper place, will talk to you about Krishna. Because everything is connected to Krishna. So if we are sober internally, everything is talking to us about Krishna. That's why the highest devotee sees Krishna everywhere. It doesn't mean that literally that devotee is seeing Krishna everywhere. Like from every atom, like tree bending form, Krishna's coming. That would be like too much. It could happen. Who am I to say it couldn't happen? But I will say probably it's more the idea to convey there is it in that level, everything is Udipana in Sanskrit. Like, Udipan, you understand the word? Like stimulant. Like example is, I don't know. If Jadubir has been out of the country for 1 decade, no? And Sri Yukan Prabhu, for whatever reason, couldn't see him for 1 decade. No? And he returns, and he recently Jadubir sent him a picture of a new pair of shoes he got. And Sri Yukan is like, why my son is sending me a picture of his new pair of shoes? And then when you're coming one day from your house, he didn't tell you he's coming, surprise visit after 10 years, but you see those pair of shoes in the door. You haven't seen him yet. But you see those parafilters, that's the Deepana. And it's like, right? So imagine the whole world as that. The whole world speaking about the object of our love, our beloved. Every atom, not only one pair of shoes, but everything becomes that. So gradually we have to train our vision to see that. It may not, we cannot start with every atom in that way, it's too much, but somewhere. Somewhere. And that somewhere gradually has to expand. That's why the tradition says, in the beginning, Kanishka Bhagavat, someone who has a more limited vision, will see God in the altar. It's great. We have to start somewhere. God is in the altar, or God is in the temple. In the, let's go to the house of God, like they will say in some traditions. The problem is, if you think God is only there, then the altar closes. Okay, God disappeared. No. I'm leaving the church or the temple or the mosque. I'm no longer in the house of God, so I can behave differently now. So still you are kind of bipolar, no? You have one personality when you enter the temple, you leave the temple, you're someone else. But gradually, if you have a proper attitude in the temple in front of the altar, you start to the altar's presence starts to extend. Oh, the altar is the house is an altar, the house is a temple, nature is a temple, the world is a temple. What is not a temple? Gradually, no? And that's why Kanishka more hyper localized. God in the altar, God in the temple. As I like to say sometimes joking, Kanishka, Kanishka, a very, very, very neophyte will say, Krishna is in, not in the altar, Krishna is in my altar. In your altar, I don't know. In my altar first, that's for sure. That's very neophyte. It's only my altar. It's all about me still, right? I mean, my altar. Eventually, you realize, no, Krishna is in other altars as well. You become more generous, more broad-minded, but nowhere else apart outside of the altars, of course. Okay, Krishna is in the temple compound, apart from the altar, a little bit there in the general room. Also, he's there, but outside of the compound, he's no longer there. Then in Madhyam, we'll see, oh, Krishna is in the altar, Krishna is in the heart of every being. And you start to relate to them accordingly. Again, it's not just saying it. Yeah, Krishna's in every heart. Okay, let me see how you relate to everyone. Because if I'm mistreating you, I'm not walking my talk. So gradually we have to reach there. Probably that's the goal to attain for most of us. No. We may not have that much problem bowing in front of the altar, praying to the deity, and that's beautiful. But then the challenge is, what happens when the curtain closes? What happens when the temple, the Sunday feast is over, so to say? Are we able to continue living in the temple, relating to the altar in everyone's heart? And as much as we're able to do that, eventually we'll universalize that vision even more. And well, there's not a place Krishna is not. Like, this was the difficulty, quote unquote, Prahlad was having with Hiranyakashipu. Say, where is your God? I don't see him anywhere. And he will look and it's like, where is he not? Wow, I cannot not find him. Oh, interesting, huh? So the one who sees God nowhere, the one who sees God everywhere, father and son. Interesting combination. It's a gradual process to reach that vision. That's a vision again. That's not just cheap wording, but lip service. But wow, and you revere everything accordingly. So even if we are not there, something that could help us to be there is start with matter, start with this world, start with nature, start with the earth, start with even all that is related to matter. Because many times when we have a toxic notion, toxic appreciation of matter, matter is bad, the world is bad, we need to leave it, it's an obstacle. Then we extend that to the body. The body is bad, terrible. Physical body, then we go to psychic body, emotions, all crap, all material stuff, all an obstacle. We have to be spiritual and transcendental. And then you start to make the greatest spiritual bypassing project of human history. Right? It becomes so transcendental and inadvertently in the way of becoming so transcendental, you end up becoming inhuman. You have zero contact with your emotions, you are neglecting your body, you are an absolute mess. But you think you are totally transcendental. And the problem is that the idea that we have of transcendence is we want to serve Krishna in Naralila. Naralila means human Lila. So how can you enter into a Lila that is fully human if you are fully humanly dysfunctional? That doesn't compute. So that's an important thing but many times all this negativity and rejection toward body, mental body, come from the root idea of matter is bad, material world is bad. The material world is not bad. Again, it's a Vaishnavi of the highest order, if I need to repeat that one more time. Material energy is the topmost Vaishnavi. If you don't agree with that, then go on and try to convince Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur who say that. I won't get into a debate with him. I trust him. I trust the Bhagavatam, again, which is saying earth first guru, let's start describing the Virat Rupa, get it right first. So, yeah, I think that's one of the main. And it's interesting because I finished my third book, Speaking on the Sacredness of Matter, but I realized that I finished my previous book, Radical Personalism. The last chapter is also about the sacredness of matter. So it was not so conscious, but then I realized, okay, it seems that this post need to be pondered in a few books and conclude with that. No, so it stays. Generally, if you read the whole book, probably you won't remember the whole book. What will say more is the very last thing you were reading. So, okay. Matter is sacred. And I not only I think, but in my personal experience, that has been a very incredible, beautiful source of inspiration and growth. You know, like, okay, I don't need to reject this world. I don't need to reject anything. No, bhakti is not about rejecting. You only need to reject, as Srila Prabhupada will say, when someone asks him, told him, "For your sake, Prabhupada, I'm willing to reject everything." No? Pretty negatively oriented approach, right? I love you so much that for the love that I have for you, I will reject everything. Is that loving or? Prabhupada say the only need you need to reject is the idea that you have to reject anything. That's the only thing you need to drop out. The idea that I have to reject. Bhakti is not about rejecting, it's about embracing everything from the proper perspective. That's it. We just need a recalibration. I need to GPS recalibrating. Okay, that's it. Like always, I like to quote, you may remember this when someone asked Srila Siddhar Maharaj, "Oh Gurudev, can you give me some service?" And he replied, "Change your angle of vision." There you have it. Some service for eternity. The naive devotee was maybe expecting go and clean the bathroom, peel some potatoes, do some stuff. I should say, "Oh, you want some service? Okay. Change your angle of vision." When you change your angle of vision enough, you will realize everything is worthy of my service. Everything is a service opportunity. I look at matter and I see a Vaishnavi to be served by me, not an inert object to be exploited and manipulated and measured and calculated. That's also sacred. I have one quote that I highlighted that I like to share in this regard, just to share some and put this sharing to rest and ask you if you have any questions also. This is a quote by, so far I've been trying to refer mostly to our own Vaishnava tradition, just for you to realize that what I'm saying is deeply embedded in our school, and it's not some like weird stuff imported from somewhere else or something. But many other traditions had a lot to say about this as well. So that's beautiful because then you see, well, there is some unanimous agreement among the mystics and the seers from various schools about how matter can reveal the absolute. Not only is not an obstacle, but properly approaches a facilitator. If I, as I said before, if I learn to listen properly, approach properly, Trinada, matter starts to speak. And people may think you're going crazy. The grass is talking to you. Okay, what else? Okay, tree teaching you tolerance. Okay, give me a moment. Yeah. I'm calling the madhouse in a sense. you are becoming mad, but mad in love of God. So that's a desirable madness. That's free will, basically. Pick your madness. All right. You become crazy in love of God, like an intoxicated lover of reality, right? Or you become mad by not becoming mad in love of God. So there is a, I was referring to an author of a quote that I like to share with you. She's, you may know her, some of you, Ilia Delio. I've talked about her a few times. I'm friends with her. She's been in my podcast. I met her in person this year, one of the many highlights of 2025. The other day I was thinking about highlights of 2025. I was like, oh, there are a lot. Well, and one of them was to meet with her in person. She's a very inspiring figure. And this book was very inspired by her, to be honest. She speaks a lot about this in, from her Christian perspective. She's a Franciscan nun. And she's also a scientist. She's a theologian. She has like four PhDs. She's super humble with four PhDs. Is that possible? Anyhow, it's possible. She's so, and she will say many interesting things. I like just to share one quote here. So she says as follows: "It is not the world, the flesh, and the flesh that are obstacles to God. It is our refusal to let God be in the world that undergirds our rejection of both God and the world. God is unbroken wholeness in movement, and creation is movement toward God-centered wholeness. Therefore, instead of standing in the world looking for God, we should stand in God and look out at the world." I'll repeat that one. "Therefore, instead of standing in the world looking for God, we should stand in God and look out at the world. If God seems absent from the world, it may be because we refuse to give birth to God in our daily lives." So, yeah, from another perspective, trying to make this point of how, if we are properly centered, a proper spiritual connection, a proper healthy relationship with the divine will show that divine presence everywhere, basically. So a very clear symptom of advancement in bhakti, literally, again, as I was mentioning, the Kanishta, the Madhyam, and the Uttam, if you pay attention, what's the yardstick to measure progress in bhakti according to those three stages? How much you are able to perceive God in the world. The first one, only the altar. The second one, every heart. The third one, everywhere. But it's all about perceiving the divine presence here and now. So again, if we see the world as something like where God cannot be present, cannot be perceived, that is an obstacle ontologically that we need to get away from here as soon as possible, we may be missing so much of divine presence, divine content, divine revelation. Again, you can attain full perfection by relating to a blade of grass. You can have a big life lesson on compassion by watching a tree. So if we say, oh, that tree is a material energy, for outside of my vision. Mahaprabhu was not saying that. Probably he embraced the tree after saying Taro Pisahishana. Probably he offered pranam to the blade of grass after saying Trinada Pisanisha. Jai Gurudev. Jai Gurudev. Tree Gurudev. Grass Gurudev. Earth Gurudevi. Right? Yeah. So. Again, the more we learn to develop this more holistic vision that is all embracing, all encompassing, that doesn't need to reject anything, we can develop, in my opinion, more healthy relationships with the world, with our own bodies, our own minds, our own psyche, our own emotions, and other people's bodies, minds, psyche, and emotions, and many things related to all those dimensions. Learning to honor all those layers. Whether we speak about physical matter, psychic matter, it's all matter, it's all mother, it's all sacred. So yeah, ultimately we are invited to a life of sacredness. Like Ilya Delia will say once, I liked how she put it in one line. It's intense, but it's beautiful. She said, the goal of life is to fall in love absolutely with the totality of reality. It's like, wow, that's hard work. That sounds beautiful. To fall in love in an absolute way with the totality of reality. Because sometimes we say the goal of life is to to love Krishna, which is true. But Krishna is Krishna plus whatever is connected to Krishna. And everything is connected to Krishna. If I love Krishna, my love for Krishna will be expressed in how I love everything else, because nothing exists in isolation from the central object of my affection. Few thoughts in connection to matter, in connection to love, to God, to us, to the potential, to love everything. Again, may sound nice words, and in terms of practice and realization, may sound a little bit like, wow, that's high level vision, but we can all start somewhere. And we may need to think, as I in my book, I include in between sections like contemplative pauses, like, okay, ask yourself how you can continue to develop your healthy being relationship with your mother matter. What can be done in your capacity, in your daily life? Well, what's a wrong assumption that you still hold about matter? What needs to be deconstructed? What false values need to be dismantled to get a more accurate view of reality? Something that is sustainable for where we are now, right? Maybe we can do an exercise. We did some last year, right? I mean, this year. We did?
We did something, yeah. It's coming. Yeah.
You survived them? Yeah. Here you are still. Why not? I mean, nothing too extreme, just simple sharing in a few for a few minutes, if you want. Just maybe sharing that in groups of three. We can organize the groups of three. Maybe for a few minutes, 3 minutes each, total of 10 minutes, sharing whatever after what we share now. Has there been any paradigm shift, any like change of perspective that, oh, I was thinking about matter in this way, and now I realize that this is the best way to relate to matter, no? And so there has there been any change of vision, and if so, in which way you think you could commit yourself to, how to say, to leave that vision, you know, to put in practice, to embrace in your daily life this new perspective you have received. So it doesn't just stay in words. Oh yeah, this new idea is cool. Yeah, but how you walk the talk, right? Trying to commit ourselves with what touch our hearts. Yeah. I'll pause the recording here. I'm recording just in case. So welcome back.
I can go. That's it.
Yeah, it's okay. Anywhere. Well, it's a few minutes.
Yeah,
Welcome back. I hope you had nourishing sharing. And so I love to do this exercise and love to see you sharing. I don't love to put an end to the exercise, and it's clear that you don't love that either, and that's why you don't care at all when I tell you it's time and you continue. Which is great. It's a great symptom. You're having a good time. So I hope you had a good sharing. And yeah, before putting the today's discussion to rest, I don't know if anyone has any pressing sharing, question, comment regarding the topic of today's sharing. For a few minutes, we can explore that, and then maybe some closing kirtan or something. And tomorrow again, we will have open Q&A to in any direction, but today maybe we can keep in the perimeter of today's discussion. Are you comfortable? You're raising your hand.
Yeah, I just want. We were talking a little bit about what you were presenting, and I had the question that you gave the example of Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, and just two poles apart kind of consciousness essentially, and it seems that one is rooted in this kind of generosity and faith that if I potentially hold space for material nature or any form of reality and allow it, it will of its own accord reveal itself, and I will be able to plumb the depths. And not I will, but it's not based, but the idea that actually there is so much more there to be availed if we're in the right headspace. And okay, so I can kind of get that, because we're all experiencing that, even just being in a sangha like this, just to have the ability to conceptualize and understand, it's all part of that non-dual kind of blessing that's floating around, that we can actually start to actually, so if we didn't have faith and giving you a moment to express yourself, then it very much influences the outcome of our experience. And so conversely, the Hiranyakashipu thing, where people might come into a, and ha already have a pre-made up a conclusion in their heads about what you're about to present. They may have so many stories. And why is it that what is the basis of that? Is it a fear-based thing that people don't allow the opportunity to seek, and so many forms in this world? What is it? Because I, especially where, okay, it's like we can so-called secular society out there, and driven by hedonistic notions, and it's kind of quite obvious they're just basically being propelled by base emotions. But within, say, a tradition where we're professing to have an understanding of the higher truth, the high goal of life, and we have a name for them, and we all accept it's Krishna and all these things, but there's quite often quite a difference in the willingness to actually give an opportunity to actually hear what these different messages that are being presented are. And I'm just wondering what your reflection on that kind of notion is. Where is that coming from? Psychological atheism, even in the guise of.
Yeah, well, when we speak about Hiranyakashipu, of course, it's
It's dramatic.
It's also the Hiranyakashipu in us, right? It's not like, oh, Prahlad, yeah, we are devotees. Prahlad's devotee. We are on Prahlad's team. Hiranyakashipu are all those evil non-devotees. I mean, how much of a devotee am I? Because it's not the orange robe on the whatever I may profess from the mouth, lip service level, but how much I'm walking my talk. So, as I mentioned in Radical Personalism, many of us engage sometimes in what's called sometimes like functional atheism. Like, I do not declare myself as an atheist, but I function as such. I behave as if God does not exist many times. Public confession by Swami Padmanabha here. So we sometimes forget that Krishna is God, that Krishna exists. Now that's the famous quote by Christian mystic Saint Teresa of Lisieux. I think it was she who said, "Prayer sometimes does not work because we pray as if God does not exist." Or we will say, okay, chant, if you chant your japa, you chant the holy names as if Krishna doesn't exist, don't expect much to happen. As if there is no real person really on the other side of the conversation. Just mumbling words, throwing words into the air may not give the actual experience that there's someone else on the other side of the phone, so to say. So sometimes we are the ones engaging in functional atheism or functional impersonalism, as much as Gaudiya Vaishnava would like to speak strongly about impersonalism. Man, we can be pretty impersonal in so many ways, even if we do not officially subscribe to, I want to merge in Brahman, but I can treat you not as a person or not as the person that you are. I can treat you partially as a person. I can treat myself very impersonally. In a very, I don't know, as I were talking before, we can engage in disembodied spirituality. That's very disconnected from all this. So that may be forms of impersonalism. I'm not honoring the person that I am, the person that you are, the person that everything is. So Mother Nature, material energy is a person. It's personified. So all this to say, again, Hiranyakashipu, despite we accepting it is a historical figure, it's also an archetype that we may be closer to than Prahlads sometimes. Let's be honest. Not to make anyone feel enter into a guilt trip, just to what it is. So why is that? I mean, of course, there is no one single answer to diagnose the whole of material creation. But one of the ones that come to mind, and you hinted at that at the end of the question, Trivikram Prabhu, is yeah, that sometimes we have a sense of identity that we are attached to, that we are quite, that gives us a sense of security and stability. And it's understandable, kind of a survival mechanism. I think I'm this person in this way, in this, that. That gives me some stability in the midst of so much instability. So we hold on to that. And when some of these new, quote unquote, ideas or invitations to grow and to transform and to change my angle of vision, all that implies a transformation in how I see myself also. And sometimes that can feel destabilizing, or it can feel like jumping into the unknown. And sometimes, I don't know if you have this in English, but in Spanish they have a saying, like better something bad but known than something better than unknown.
The devil you know than the one you don't.
Yeah, something like that. So even if it's not fully, totally fulfilling, not totally satisfying, I stay with the what I know, not certainty. Again, I'm not condemning those who do that. We all do that in so many ways. But gradually, we should be willing to explore something else. What's all that I can be? My potential. There are so many deeper versions of myself. There is a point that the version that I am is no longer operative. Operative? Like an app in the phone. No, that may be a proper analogy for this time and day. You have an a certain version of certain app in your phone, and at one point it comes the option, okay, we have the newer one. And the older one still works, but at some point becomes like clumsy. Still works, and no, I don't want to download the latest one. I keep this one. And it said maybe at one point I will say you have to download the latest one. You kind of work with now. Sometimes you feel that like in life, no, like I'm okay. I'm keeping my older version of myself as much as I can, but at one point, life circumstances like stop. You cannot move forward with this anymore. You have to upgrade, upgrade, embrace a higher version of yourself. Even if we were terrified to do that for some time, and that's why we didn't do it. But sometimes we, by force of circumstance, we are sometimes from. Do the quantum leap. And again, baby will be scary and all that. That's why it's so important to have good company and good friends, and also elders and people who are, in one sense, one of the main reasons to have people more advanced than us in our life. It's not just to like to impose a hierarchy on you have more advanced people, but in practical implications is you have people in your life who have taken the steps that you are terrified now about taking. And they are telling you, I was as terrified as you were now, as you are now. And it cost me a lot to do that, but I gradually did that, and I'm here, I'm alive, I haven't died. It's way better on the other side. So and it gives that te life testimony and that support. And I say, like, take my hand and we go together. We jump off the cliff together. Because we may be too terrified to jump on ourselves. So maybe those elders will even jump themselves before we. I won't jump. The elder comes. I'll jump. We say the other day. We jump. Say, go,
Like
Haribo.
starting to
And
skydiving
well,
type thing.
yeah, I don't. That's what we are doing in one sense in a spiritual. And yeah, they jump first. They return and show I jumped. Krishna caught me down. I was safe. Now let's jump together. Well, so that's important, having elders and more advanced people, you know, in one sense that they are. It's not that they didn't go through the same fears and doubts and crises that we were. We went. They went, but they went through them, and that's why they become elders and examples to follow. That doesn't mean that they don't have a clue what I'm going through. They are so advanced that they have never been touched by my messiness. No, they went through the whole thing. And now that's why they can become reference and role model for us. And they can understand where we are. They can accompany us in that journey. Because yeah, it can be fearful. It can be scary. That's why Krishna says at the end, what's the conclusion of the Gita? Sarva dharmam parityajam amekam sharanam brajam mam mokshishami means masuchaha. That's the word they want. Don't fear. No. And at the beginning of the Gita, also Krishna says, don't fear. And at the end, he said, don't fear. Why Krishna says so many times, don't fear? Because we are. Again, not to feel bad about ourselves, just like it's scary to let go of an older version of ourselves and embrace a new one. It's scary because will there be a new one? I don't want to end up in a limbo with no self at all. So. Better again to hold to the old one and still there is something there than nothing. So that's why we need those people who will embody there is something else. It's not that there's nothing. There's something even deeper, more beautiful, more satisfying, more everything. So because if we don't have that reference, we won't move. We'll frozen because I don't know what's there. So the unknown will paralyze us. So in the midst of so much uncertainty, we need some certainty. And the presence of advanced sadhus somehow ideally provide that certainty. Like there is something on the other side. We are waiting there for you and we are coming back and accompanying you back there. So it's like, okay. Then gradually we take some courage, we gather some momentum. And we realize, oh yeah, it's way better here. Well, it took me a few lifetimes to make that jump, that leap, but I'm happy I did it. So that's a way of why maybe that sometimes we, and again, all this I'm trying to say, not in any way that we feel like enter a toxic trip of guilt and shame about I'm not there yet or whatever, but mostly trying to see all that with understanding and compassion also. It can be scary and it's understandable. And from that place, understanding and compassion, trying to give hope and support to each other and moving to the next step. Whatever next step each other has to do, there's always some fear in that next step and then and the other next step. And it's part of the journey also to acknowledge that, not to stigmatize. No. You cannot be fearful. If you are fearful, you are bad. You should not be fearful. That doesn't make any sense. You have to be courageous, no? And courageous means that you are being fearful. And still you, no? If I don't feel fearful, I cannot be courageous. I can't be brave from my comfort zone. I'm sitting here very comfortable, like everything is fine, everything is in order. I'm being very courageous now. No, I need to be put in a circumstance where I'm like challenged and there is uncertainty. And in the context of that, I'm confirmed doing some courageous acts. But again, sometimes we need that support, that backing for us to be courageous. It's just on ourselves.
So it would seem that that association is what we would sort of expect out of a movement that we joined, isn't it? Isn't that the kind of idea of a like-minded association of Vaishnavas, that they actually understand that and they have things in place in order to try and do that? Of course, yeah, in the absence of that, I guess you find other things, but.
I mean, I wouldn't say that there's an absence of that. I will say probably that we join a movement with over expectations, like with some naivete, thinking everyone and everything will be that. Instead of realizing everyone is in their own journey, and it's not that everyone is an elder, self-realized, mature sadhu. And most people are probably in the same part of the journey that I am in. Not all, hopefully. And then there are always still some elders here. An elder doesn't mean older, just in case. The Bhagavatam gives a very interesting idea of elderhood. The main guru is a 16-year-old boy. Sukadev Goswami, right? And an older person, Parikshit Maharaj, accepting as a guru someone who could be his son in terms of age. So elderhood is more about inner depth and growth. So yeah, we all join the movements, different institutions, different groups, with some expectations, with some needs, with some ideas, and of course, other people have chosen to do things that may have hurt us, but also we have come from a certain place. We have to take responsibility for our views, and we learn throughout time. And I'm sure all of us, I won't ask now for public confession, but all of us, we are not the same persons since the day we joined, and now, and certain ideas we had have changed. Hopefully, not in any way that made us cynical or like bitter and resentful, because that's not the place to go. But hopefully experienced and mature and more understanding and compassionate to others, to ourselves, and not over-idealizing and over-expecting, but also not losing hope that what we need is still there and available. We may need to look for it, and we may find it in a few people that we can count with the fingers of one hand, and that's enough. Yeah. Because with how many people can you have deep, intimate, personal relationship that can grow throughout a lifetime? You can do that. We cannot do that with 3,000 people, with 3 million people. It's overwhelming. I have 5,000 friends in Facebook, but I know hardly half of them. So yeah, they are friends in Facebook terms, but real friendship, deep personal connection, radically personal, we spend time. I mean, as much as I like to get to know each one of those 5,000, I don't have time. So we need to also spend time, quality time with those few people that we feel, well, this is family, this is my tribe, this is my village, this home. We are growing, we are learning from each other. And that's the quality association that Krishna refers to in the Gita, right? 10, chapter 10, 9, verse 9. Machitamad gata. My devotees get together, they enlighten one another. Tushyanticha, they nourish one another. Ramanticha, they experience a taste, a pleasure in that exchange, in that sharing. They are well wishers to one another. Doesn't need, in some cases, it doesn't even need to be someone much way more advanced than someone not so advanced. It can be even peers, brothers, sisters. But they share from such an honest, vulnerable place that the higher current descends through the peers. Let's say it's a group of Madhyam Bhaktas, but if they are all very honest, an Uttam current descends through the Madhyam. So that's possible. And again, we shouldn't be expecting or reclaiming the movement. Why you are not all Uttam Bhagavatas, or why you are not per. It's easy to take it on the movement, you know, and to start to blame an institution or a massive group. But at the end of the day, in those big groups, they are always hopefully providing some quality sangha with people. And at the end of the day, it's personal. I mean, we as I like to say, and I hope you understand my point, I have nothing against institution, but I cannot be, we cannot belong to an institution. We can be officially affiliated to an institution, but belonging, you can just belong to a heart. So at the end of the day, it's personal relationships with people. Even if you are in the context of a particular institution never replaces personalism. What's an institution without the people? Of course, sometimes, unfortunately, people end up putting more importance to the institution than to the people. And that's not serving the original purpose and of a spiritual institution of this. So. But yeah. Yeah, that quality association is there, and whatever that is, Tatra laulyam api phalam mulyam, like Rupa Goswami said, you have to be greedy for that. In whatever circumstance you find that, go for it. There are no relative consider all relative considerations are thrown out of the window in the pursuit of the absolute thirst and search for quality association. Oh, but that devotee that is so nourishing is not from the institution. It's okay, no problem. I mean, as long as it's nourishing, it's really nourishing. It's not like disturbing and creating a hole. There is a possibility of again. We have to be, I mean, there are institutional considerations that remember that at one point in history there were no institutions. You cannot ask Bhaktivinoda Thakur to which mission you belong. It's like, in which institution are you affiliated to Rupa Goswami? There were no institutions. And I'm not saying again that it was a problem that there are institutions. We are here because of the effort of an institution. But we should not over-absolutize that to the point that it gets in the way of personal relationship and the quality sangha we can have with one another. So there is a place for trans-institutional commitment and connections without discarding or insulting the institution either. But anyhow, those are just my thoughts. Something else? I said a few brief questions and answer, and we are starting another lecture. Okay. We can put the sharing to rest today. And tomorrow, invite to continue sharing in the evening. We'll be opening the space for any questions or topics or explorations you may have in any direction. Taboo talks, welcome. Can of worms, welcome. All weathers of the heart are welcome. So we can put to rest maybe for a few minutes. We can have some short kirtan. We have time.
We will, and
We have eternity on our side supporting us. श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री नाम संकीर्तन की जय, साधु संग की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद जी।